This week marked the beginning of Lent, and you know, Lent is traditionally a time in the church calendar when we look forward to Good Friday and to Easter. And traditionally, through church history, people at the time of Lent have given up something. So, you know, the phrase "I gave it up for Lent." We've also been in the middle of a series on giving, or I don't know if it's the middle. We may be at the end of a series on giving, but we've had this series on giving, and so we've got, you know, Lent giving up things. We've got a series on giving. So the topic today seems fairly obvious. We're going to talk about Enoch, Hebrews chapter 11. There is a connection, but you'll have to wait a while to find it. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 5. By faith Enoch was taken from this life, so that he did not experience death. He could not be found, because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. Now, this sermon is actually born of there's a bit of a history to it, and you can actually, if you like or don't like this sermon, you can either thank or blame Clara afterwards, because it's Clara's fault we're having this sermon today. This sermon was born of a series about a year ago that we were in Sunday school talking about Hebrews chapter 11, this roll call of faith. And Hebrews chapter 11 is this magnificent chapter with endless numbers of fantastic examples of faith. These just mighty warriors who do all these incredible things. You get Moses parting water. You get David killing giants. You get Joshua. There's some really exciting stories. And right in the middle, well, actually, it's not even in the middle, towards the beginning of this series is Enoch. And Clara was in the Sunday school class. I was teaching the Sunday school class, and Clara's in there. Week after week, I'm going in, we're making the roll call of faith on the chalkboard week after week, and week after week, Clara sits down and says, "You know what? It's stupid that Enoch is on this list." She was so irritated about Enoch's presence on this list of things. We heard about it every single week, about just the idiocy. What is he doing there? What is Enoch? What did he do? Well, you look back to the story of Enoch in Genesis chapter 5. This is what we find out that Enoch did. This great example. Genesis chapter 5, verse 24. Enoch walked with God, then he was no more. And that's actually not a really great translation. The King James actually gets it both literally and nice. Enoch walked with God and was not, because God took him away. That's it. That's the entire story of Enoch. And so Clara's sitting there week after week saying, "What did this guy do? He walked with God and was not." And I tried to sell the sort of, there's something really interesting philosophically about this, because what do we know about Enoch? He was and was not. Can you both be and be not? And, you know, what does it mean to say you were not when you were? And she just didn't buy it, that this was interesting enough about Enoch to make it. And so we're just sort of going through, and then you think, okay, well, what else do we know about Enoch? Well, he's mentioned here. He shows up in Luke in the long list. There's a genealogy in Luke, starting with Adam running through Jesus, and since, you know, we have to run through all the people, Enoch gets mentioned in the list along with lots of other people we don't care about. So he sort of mentioned this one time. He rates exactly one other mention in Jude. And we'll look at it briefly, and we'll see why we'll only look at it briefly. Jude, verse 14. Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men. "See, the Lord is coming with thousands upon thousands of his holy ones to judge everyone and to convict all the ungodly of all the ungodly acts they have done in the ungodly way and of all the harsh words ungodly sinners have spoken against him." There's a quotation here from an apocryphal book that's attributed to Enoch. We have no idea who really wrote it, but sort of there's this book that's sort of the book of Enoch, and there's a quotation here in Jude from this book, and so Enoch gets mentioned as the author of it. What does this have to do with Enoch? And you realize the quotation has absolutely nothing to do with Enoch. Our entire biblical example of Enoch is, Enoch walked with God and was not, for God took him, and he makes the roll call of faith for that alone. And this really irritated Clara. And so part of what we want to think about today is, well, what is Enoch doing in this roll call of faith? Why does he rise to this level? So I had promised Clara at the time that someday we're going to have an entire sermon on Enoch, and she was really skeptical that you could spin this out and spend all this time talking about Enoch. So we'll find out. So how can we do this? And in order to do this, we have to look back to Genesis, because this is really the only place we have. And it's worth noting in a second that Genesis is a book that over time I have been finding incredibly fascinating in ways I never thought about. You know, you grow up in church and you go to Sunday school, and there's a lot of good stories in Genesis, and it seems like this nice little set of stories. But one of the things, you know, over the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, I spent a lot of time sort of thinking about the great books of Western civilization. You know, sort of you think about Shakespeare and Dante and Homer and all these guys. And one of the really fascinating things I've been finding about Genesis is it actually stands on that level. Genesis turns out to be one of these incredible incredibly intricate books that just sort of not only has all the sorts of lessons we normally draw out in sort of in churches and Sunday school, but it is a marvelously put together book that just on pure literary merits alone stands at sort of the level of the great books in the history of the world. Now, this isn't surprising to Christians because we all like to think, you know, Genesis, it was written by God ultimately, and so it must be really great. But it really is a sort of this magnificent example of sort of all these sort of clever things going on in the way the text is written. The other thing we need to note about Genesis, sort of up front, because it'll sort of, you know, play throughout, is when Christians look at Genesis, particularly the early parts of Genesis, there are two giant schools of thought, and very godly people and very righteous people and people who study the Bible have split dramatically on how to read these early chapters. And the big question in sort of the debate is this sort of early parts of Genesis a literary retelling of history that we're supposed to read as sort of these literary tellings, or is it sort of this historically accurate account? In some ways, the comparison is, we think about Homer's accounts of the war in Troy, and Homer's writing this account on the war of Troy. We know there was this big Trojan war, and the Greeks and the Trojans had this big battle, but nobody really thinks Homer's relating the conversations as they actually happened. I mean, he's living too far after the fact. So he's sort of telling the story. There's an enormous number of moral lessons in there. He's trying to teach us something in writing this book. So one way that many serious Christians have looked at it is said, Genesis is like that. There's an actual history here, and what we're reading in the early chapters of Genesis is this literary retelling of it to teach us these moral lessons. The other way people look at it is in many ways like George Nash's books on Herbert Hoover. George Nash writes books on Herbert Hoover, and if it's in there, you know it's right. I mean, there's no doubt about it. By the time it enters in and it's written there, it has been exhaustively researched, and it is conclusive beyond any doubt whatsoever. And so maybe Genesis is like that. The author of Genesis is like an early George Nash, and I think this is the first time George has ever been compared to Homer, but I'm not sure. So which way we read Genesis, it's a kind of an interesting discussion. But ultimately, for thinking about the moral lesson, what are we supposed to learn from Genesis, it doesn't matter whether it's an accurate historical account or whether it's a literary. The lessons of Genesis are the same either way. So we'll set it to the side. It doesn't matter which way you read them. The story that we're going to be telling here is identical, whether these are all meant to be literally telling or literary. So what is the story of this early part of Genesis that gets us to Enoch? And to get at it, we have to back up one chapter before the Enoch chapter. Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4 starts with the story of Cain and Abel. And so, you know, well, first of all, well, we have the passage Joe read before. You know, there's the great sin, sort of. Adam breaks, and they eat of the fruit, and they are cursed, right? And they, you know, God had told them, the day you eat of the fruit, you shall surely die. They eat of it anyway. They are cast out of the garden, and they are cursed. The next thing that happens is Adam and Eve's sons, Cain and Abel, are out there. Abel gives a sacrifice that's pleasing to God. Cain doesn't. Cain gets irritated with his brother and kills him. And so then Cain is sort of punished and he's sort of cast out. And, you know, God says, well, you know, you're going to have to go off. And we get this story then of what happens immediately afterwards. Genesis chapter 4, verse 16. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain lay with his wife, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. Now, this is a different Enoch than the one we'll see in the next chapter. And it's not surprising to us, if we're imagining reading this for the first time, that Enoch is here, because we don't know anything about another Enoch yet. So he gives birth to Enoch. Cain was then building a city, and he named it after his son Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad was the father of Mahujael, and Mahujael was the father of Methusael. I have no idea how to pronounce these names, by the way, but I'll pretend like I do. Methusael. And Methusael was the father of Lamech. Lamech married two women, one named Adah and the other named Zillah. Adah gave birth to Jabal, who was the father of those who live in tents and raise livestock. His brother's name was Jubal, and he was the father of all who play the harp and flute. Zillah also had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. Tubal-Cain's sister was Naamah. Lamech said to his wives, "Adah and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times." This is sort of the story of Cain's lineage. And there's something kind of surprising about Cain's lineage. And we see it sort of as we get to Lamech. Lamech is kind of an interesting guy here. Lamech is the seventh generation. So we start from Adam, we get down to Lamech, he's the seventh. The number seven, straight through, particularly the Old Testament, but also through the Bible, the number seven is like one of these magic numbers. It's like a number of completeness. And, you know, largely it's the 7 days of creation. So here we are at the seventh generation, and in some sense we now know this is the complete story of Cain here. We've hit the seventh generation, we're completing the story, and what do we know about Lamech? Well, he went out and killed somebody. And Lamech is the descendant of Cain, and what do we know about Cain? Cain also went out and killed somebody. Like father, like son. What do we have here in the descendants of Cain? We have a generation after generation. The entire lineage is starting with a murderer, and it's ending with a murderer. This is not a happy family story here. I mean, this is sort of the people that you're looking at and you're saying, you know, this is the bloodline that's sort of running through, and year after year after year, we're imagining these people that are not only murdering, but by the time we get to Lamech, he's proud of being a murderer. He's bragging about being a murderer. He's going to go, I've killed a man for wounding me, a young man, which can be read, a boy for injuring me. He's not only proud of murder, he's murdering children, and he's sort of proud of this thing. And Lamech is the kind of guy we'd say, you know, not no savory kind of guy. And we have here the lineage of Cain, which is a lineage of people that are not doing good. And it turns out we actually got that clue even earlier with Cain's son, Enoch. There's another curious thing about Cain's son, Enoch. Cain lay with his wife and she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. Cain was then building a city and he named it after his son, Enoch. And this is kind of curious. You know, we got the city and the son and they've got the same name. But why is Cain building a city? If we back up a bit in the story, Cain is talking to God. Verse 9, chapter 4. The Lord said to Cain, where is your brother Abel? I do not know, he replied. Am I my brother's keeper? The Lord said, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth. Here's the curse. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth. Cain leaves, and what's the first thing he goes out and does? Builds a city? He's not wandering at all. He goes out, and instead of becoming a restless wanderer, he immediately puts down roots, builds a city, and names his son after the city, or the city after his son. It turns out it can be read either way, but the son and the city become identical, and he's building a city, and he's not wandering at all, and he grounds himself, and then what do we have? Generation after generation, ending with Lamech, the murderer. This is another family born in disobedience and runs straight through in disobedience until its completion. But there's another lineage, chapter 5. And we tend to skip these lineages because, well, as we can see in chapter 5 one, it's a little repetitive. In fact, it's not a little repetitive. It's a lot repetitive. But it turns out the repetition, again, this is sort of the marvelous way Genesis is put together. The repetition itself tells us something because it's when the repetition breaks, suddenly we think, eh, there might be something important about the break. So we'll read this, chapter 5. This is the written account of Adam's line. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them. And when they were created, he called them man. When Adam lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image, and he named him Seth. After Seth was born, Adam lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Adam lived 930 years, and then he died. When Seth had lived 105 years, he became the father of Enosh. And after he became the father of Enosh, Seth lived 807 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Seth lived 912 years, and then he died. When Enosh lived 90 years, he became the father of Kenan. And after he became the father of Kenan, Enosh lived 815 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enosh lived 905 years, and then he died. When Kenan had lived 70 years, he became the father of Mahalalel. And after he became the father of Mahalalel, Kenan lived 840 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Kenan lived 910 years, and then he died. When Mahalalel lived 65 years, he became the father of Jared. And after he became the father of Jared, Mahalalel lived 830 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Mahalalel lived 895 years, and then he died. When Jared lived 162 years, he became the father of Enoch. And after he became the father of Enoch, Jared lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Jared lived 962 years, and then he died. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. And after he became the father of Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enoch lived 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and then was not, because God took him away. When Methuselah lived 187 years, he became the father of Lamech. And after he became the father of Lamech, Methuselah lived 782 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Methuselah lived 969 years, and then he died. When Lamech had lived 182 years, he had a son. He named him Noah, and he said, "He will comfort us in the labor and painful toil our hands have caused by the ground the Lord has cursed." After Noah was born, Lamech lived 595 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Lamech lived 777 years, and then he died. After Noah was 500 years old, he became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and then it breaks off. Now you'll note, that was a really repetitive chapter, but there are three times the repetitiveness breaks. The last time is the Noah. Why does Noah break right in the middle? And this isn't shocking to us, because if we know what comes after, Noah actually gets a really interesting story. Clara never had a problem with Noah being in the Roll Call of Faith. I mean, Noah does the whole build the boat thing. I mean, this is kind of new and exciting. Noah's gonna do something interesting. The other interesting thing about Noah, though, is Noah is the 10th generation. 10 is another one of these great numbers of completeness, probably because we have 10 fingers, and so, you know, that's how high we can count without having to double up or something. But 10 is a good number. Noah is the 10th generation, and so here we have another lineage ending in the 10th generation. The story stops there, and then we move forward with all sorts of exciting things that we'll have to talk about some other time. So we have the 10 there, and that's the first thing, sort of why is it breaking? Right before that, Lamech also has a huge break in the narrative. The first thing we can note is we've seen the name Lamech before. Cain has a Lamech. And you'll note what was different in Cain's Lamech is Lamech in Cain's generation was the first person who said anything. Also in this one, Seth's Lamech is the first person who says anything. So we got the two Lamechs. They're both talking, but they talk about really different things. Lamech goes out and brags about murdering people. Cain's Lamech does. Seth's Lamech goes out, has his son Noah, meaning comfort, and he says, "He will comfort us in the labor and painful toil of our hands caused by the ground the Lord has cursed." He's talking about a birth, he's talking about comfort, but the shock of it we can't really get until we sort of think about what's been going on in chapter 5. One of the things that happens in chapter 5 is because it's sort of organized by people. And there's a chronology there, but it turns out, if you sort of go back and work through the chronology, if we put the chapter in actual chronological order, what happens? Well, this is what happens. Adam has a son, Seth. Seth is born. Seth has a son, Enosh. Enosh has a son, Kenan. Kenan has the son, Mahalalel. Mahalalel has a son, Jared. Jared has a son, Enoch. Enoch has a son, Methuselah. Methuselah has a son, Lamech. Adam dies. That's when Adam dies in the story. You work through all the numbers. Adam dies after Lamech is born, but before Noah is born. Noah is the first person born in this lineage after the death of Adam, as I'm sort of reading through the narrative. Now, this is a little bit shocking if you think about it, because what we're imagining here is a story where Adam's here and he has a kid who has a kid who has a kid, and we've got 9 generations alive. Nobody's died except for the murdered people. Cain murdered Abel. Cain's Lamech has murdered somebody else. We have no natural death anywhere in this story, and we're imagining generation after generation after generation, people are born, we have untimely deaths when somebody is murdered, and then suddenly, Adam dies. Now, should it be a shock that Adam dies? Well, we're all used to people dying, that's not a shock. But Adam's dying not because he was murdered in this story. The curse of God to Adam was, when you eat of the fruit, you will die. And here we are, generation after generation, and Adam's still living, and Adam's still living, and Adam's still living. And then suddenly, Adam dies. That's kind of a shocking turn of events in a story. If you're imagining reading this for the first time going through, I mean, what does this mean that Adam just died? And then Noah is going to be born. And what is Lamech saying? He will comfort us in the labor and painful toil of our hands caused by the ground the Lord has cursed. Adam has died. You can imagine the shock, but now there's another birth. And with the other birth, you can imagine, you know what? We've got the curse here. We've got the pain and the toil of the curse, and yet There's more life to come. There's more generations to come. And we know what happens when Adam dies. When Adam dies, suddenly you realize, well, wait a minute, maybe everybody's mortal. And setting Enoch aside for a second, that's exactly what we see. Adam dies, and then Seth dies, and then Enosh dies, and then Kenan dies, and Mahalalel dies, and Jared dies, and then oddly Lamech dies before Methuselah. So Lamech dies, and then Methuselah dies. Noah is born, the only other recorded birth, right after Seth's death, and so he's sort of born in the middle of all of it. The Lamech-Methuselah thing is also kind of interesting for another reason, of sort of capturing sort of the completeness of the picture. Lamech dies before Methuselah, but note when Lamech dies. Lamech lives 777 years and then he died. And there's something interesting about dying at the age of 777. Cain's Lamech did what? Well, he bragged. If Cain is avenged seven times, complete number of times, then Lamech 77 times. It's like Cain's Lamech is saying, well, you know, Cain has seven times that he was going to be avenged. I'm going to be avenged 77 times. And then Seth's Lamech lives 777 years. It's like it's super completeness. It's like even better than what Cain's Lamech got. And it's sort of this curiosity, sort of this great, like, wow, this is something really amazing about living 777 years. What a perfect age to die at, right? You've got the three sevens in a row. This is just a great age. Methuselah lives longer. Methuselah's age is also actually kind of interesting. Methuselah comes closer to anybody to the magic age of 1,000. 1,000 would be a super complete age because what is it? It's 10 times 10 times 10. It's 3 tens, 10 to the third. 10, a perfect number. 3 is also a really great perfect number. So you get 10 raised to the third power. Living to be 1,000 would be magnificently complete, but he dies shortly before it in the year of the flood, interestingly enough. Methuselah dies the same year the flood hits. So how did he die? Well, it doesn't tell us, but it's not hard to imagine how he died shortly before Methuselah. He's tantalizingly close to making it to the magic age of 1,000, and God resets, floods the earth, and Methuselah dies. Doesn't quite make it either. And we sort of have this sort of record and these lineages of deaths going on, but in the middle of all of this, we get the curious case of Seth's Enoch. What happens to Enoch? Well, Enoch enters the story at an interesting point. If we go through and we just sort of line up everything chronologically, we have all of these births getting down to Lamech. Adam suddenly dies. We now know what's going to come next, all the deaths, but that's not what comes next. After Adam dies, the next thing that happens is Enoch was not. Now, this is even more shocking than sort of Adam's death, if you think about it. We get the idea that Adam will die. This is now death has entered the world and everybody's going to die. Why in the world doesn't Enoch die? Why is it he suddenly was not? It's almost like we get this sudden image in the Genesis chapter 5 account of the curse has come, people are under the curse, and they're going to die. We now know that because Adam died, and the very next thing that happens is Enoch doesn't die. And it's not that he just keeps living, it's that he doesn't die, and he never will die, because he was not. And you think, is it possible? Is it possible to escape the curse of death? Is it possible somehow that while Adam will die, and we're all born under the curse, and we're all going to die, is it possible to escape it? And what did Enoch do? He walked with God. Is it possible that walking with God is all one has to do to escape the curse of death, to escape the consequences of sin? And suddenly you realize right here, buried in Genesis chapter 5, is the gospel message. Of course it's possible that walking with God, we can escape the consequences of our sin. And it's buried right here in the story of Enoch, that Enoch walked with God and he was not. And then we move on with the rest of the story and the consequences of sin, and ultimately all of the sin runs rampant through the earth and the flood and the rest of the narrative and the rise of Israel or so on. But Enoch walked with God and was not becomes a really important lesson at the early part of Genesis. And you'll note it's the same lesson that plays itself out all through Genesis, through the Old Testament, and through the Bible. We can no longer live in Eden. We were born, we were created to be in Eden. This is sort of the birth of humanity right here in the presence of God. And what's going on there? It's amazing, this presence of God. And we're cast out. Where then are we going to live? when we're cast out? I mean, where do we live? And what we have immediately after the casting out is we get two different generations. One generation, Cain's Enoch, grounds itself on earth. Cain's Enoch has the exact same name as the city. He's identified as the city. He's identified as not being a wanderer on the earth, but somebody who is living on the earth, making a home on the earth, permanent on the earth. What are the concerns of Cain's Enoch? Well, it would be the concerns of this world. And then we have Seth's Enoch. And where does Seth's Enoch live? Well, not on this earth. He was not. He doesn't live on this earth. Enoch walked with God. The walked with is exactly the same as God walked in the Garden of Eden. Adam used to walk with God. And then Adam broke faith and was cast out. Enoch walked with God, not on this earth, somewhere else. And he's taken home and he walks out of the story. And we have here this interesting kind of comparison for all of us of where are we going to live our lives? Are we going to live them here, mired in the concerns of this world? Or do we walk with God and live elsewhere? What does this have to do with Lent? Well, everything, you realize. What is Lent? Lent is looking forward to Good Friday and Easter. And what happens at Good Friday and Easter? Christ gives up everything for us. He walks out of heaven, comes down to enable us to walk with God at all. And Lent is the traditional time of the church calendar where we acknowledge, you know what? Christ can give up everything. Why am I so reluctant to give up anything? What does it have to do with giving? Everything. Why is giving such a hard issue for Christians? Why are we always want the rules about how much to give? And it's because fundamentally we want to be like Cain's Enoch. Fundamentally we want to live here, we want to worry about our things, and then we know we got to buy off God somehow. So if I could just know how much of my stuff I have to give, I'm good, because then I can worry about my stuff and I can have all my stuff. But imagine we just lived our lives like Seth's Enoch. We walked with God. Giving is the most trivially easy thing in the world to imagine. I mean, we'd be going through life. We're walking with God. We give, we don't give. We enjoy the things of the world while we have them. And then we give them away when other people need them. We're not concerned with sort of rules or trying to figure out, am I doing enough? I mean, you imagine being Seth's Enoch. How is it we think about giving? Well, here's the interesting thing. Imagine if every day we woke up and we asked God, we prayed to God, please give me the desire to give more. Fundamentally different than the way we normally think. We always think of it, how much should I give? But imagine we just prayed for the desire to give more. We hold on to the things of this world lightly, and if they come, we enjoy them, and if they leave, they leave, and we just go through our life walking with God day after day after day. I mean, giving wouldn't even be the kind of thing we talk about. We talk about all sorts of other fascinating things, but you realize how much of our lives would be like that if we could do this. In many ways, when we think about this idea of faith, we have these examples of all of these great heroes of faith who do amazing things, but they all present a fundamental problem for us. I am highly unlikely in my life to ever need to part waters and lead the people of God across a giant ocean. I am highly unlikely to ever be faced with a giant Philistine and have to throw a stone and kill him. I am highly unlikely to ever have to march around a city and cause the walls to drop. All of these great heroes of the faith are great, but if I live my life saying, I want to be more like Moses, what does that mean for me? And I realize, I don't know. Moses is a complicated guy. He has this fascinating role in life. There's a lot about Moses that I can learn from. There's a lot about him I would like to emulate. There's parts about Moses I wouldn't want to emulate. I mean, there's all sorts. He's a really complicated guy, and he's so complicated because he did all these amazing things, and we know so much about him. And you think about all these other people, they're just like that. They all do these amazing things, and they're incredible, and they're great. But they're complicated human individuals. And then we think about Enoch. What did Enoch do? Well, that's the beauty of Genesis chapter 5. He walked with God, and that's all we're told about him. You know what? I could be like Enoch. If you were gonna make a short list of the roll call of faith, and you wanted just one example of a person who had faith that I could live my entire life trying to emulate, never once having to say, well, maybe I don't quite want to be like this person in this respect. We want one example of faith. That short list would be, by faith, Enoch walked with God. Enoch not only belongs on this, he's the list on the roll call of faith. And this is what I'm hoping from his and Clara. He is the example of faith for all of us, of this person that if we could learn to be like Enoch, we could learn to walk with God day in and day out. We don't need any other examples of faith. We don't need anything else in our life. If we learn to walk with God, we too will be not, for God will take us home. Let's pray. God, we thank you. We thank you, first of all, for the gift of your Son, and that, God, you made all of this possible, that we have any hope of ever pleasing you, we have any hope of ever seeing you, and we have any hope of being with you for all eternity. And God, we know we deserve to live and die under the curse, for we've all sinned. And God, we stand in awe that you care enough about us to make it possible that we can escape this curse. God, help us this week to learn, day by day and moment by moment, to walk with you. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. You can take